You know those lyrics? Tutti Frutti, Oh Rudy. Not the original lyrics. Did you know that? Little Richard wanted to sing Tutti Frutti, Good Booty. That was too scandalous, so he had to change it. NPR music writer Ann Powers has a new book about the history of sex and music, and her book is titled Good Booty. Good Booty, Love and Sex, Black and White, Body and Soul in American Music. Ann Powers told KOW's Jeannie Yandel why she wanted to name the book for some lyrics that nobody's ever heard.
I was sitting in my office and, you know, kind of gazing out hopelessly over the task of what can I name my book? And there I saw the biography of Little Richard, and the song just started playing in my head. And because I'd researched the song and knew that the original lyrics were these dirty, greasy lyrics about sex, it immediately started playing in my head. And I thought, good booty. That's perfect.
Clearly, Tutti Frutti wasn't the beginning of sex in popular music. Did you find a beginning point? Is there like a marked beginning point for this?
Well, the beginning point of American popular music being a way for people to express desire, longing, yearning, pleasure is really the beginning of this nation. And that's why I go way, way back and start at the turn of the 19th century in 1807. In the first chapter of Good Booty, I really tried to explore how Africans who had been enslaved preserved their legacies and made a new culture by creating a language of music that felt like a secret. And they, you know, that was right there out in public, but carried secrets inside of it, even, you know, in the rhythms, not just in the lyrics. And that's really why I think American music became such a conduit for what everyone has trouble talking about, because it was this way that things were carried on.
I've got a song here that I want you to listen to by Josephine Baker. Now, obviously, she did not live in the early 1800s, but she was an African-American artist. She left the country and she explored some of the stuff that you're talking about. And sometimes it was secretive. It wasn't frank.
All the cold
J'ai deux amours is part of a song tradition that I explore in the book, Creole songs that came through the Caribbean and to the southern U.S. via the African Caribbean diaspora. These songs told intimate stories of relationships in antebellum times, often relationships between enslaved people or between enslaved people and their masters or mistresses. You know, the mixture of people, the connections between people, sometimes under oppression, sometimes in violation, sometimes in love, that these songs tell the story of.
Mon pays et Paris.
I'm talking with Ann Powers, NPR's music critic. We're talking about her new book, Good Booty, and this subtitle. I want to talk about the subtitle. Love and Sex, Black and White, Body and Soul in American Music. There is a lot to talk about there, but let's start with black and white.
Yeah.
How does race play into this topic that you decided to tackle, sexual themes in American popular music?
Two things. One, I knew that if I was going to write a kind of sweeping history of American music, that I would inevitably be writing about race and racial oppression, the legacies of slavery, the resilience of African American people, because I believe that American music is African American music, and there is no style or genre of American music that's not touched by those legacies. It's not as simple as black and white. It's definitely more than just that binary. But the binary is important because the binary has created so much mythology, so much bad habits of thinking in our society, things we're dealing with now, you know. What I really didn't want was to equate black with primitive or raw or, you know, closer to the libido or any of those bad habits of thinking, those cliches that I think are really a problem and that a lot of music writers have fallen into. What I wanted to do was show the sophistication and the elegance of the way that enslaved Africans created these new forms out of what they brought over and preserved their spirits through music. And then as the centuries wore on, continued to do that in different ways.
I want to talk a little bit about another one of the places and times that you explore in the book. We could spend a lot of time talking about Jimi Hendrix and the life that he lived in Seattle in the 50s and the 40s. But you actually spent a lot of time in your book talking about New York in the 1920s. Mm. It shows me you could have chosen many different times and places to focus on in this book, but you chose this place for a reason. New York, 1920s, blues musicians. Why?
Well, New York in the 20s was such an incredibly vibrant, exciting place for music, for theater, for street culture. There was also so much dancing. And I always looked to wherever people were dancing the most. And the embodiment and the epitome of the modern. So women are coming into their own, you know, they're expressing a new sense of their own freedom. Married couples are trying to have a more zingy relationships. Sexology, the kind of like the joy of sex 1920s style was really popular. Couples were reading up on how to be better lovers. They were looking to performers to teach them about that. And the music's just so fun, you know. It's very racy sometimes, just hilarious. Just, I wish I could time travel back there.
Well, I have a piece of music from that time from Bessie Smith that you're going to recognize this as soon as I play this. I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl.
Tired of being lonely.
I have to point out here, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, I Want a Little Hot Dog on My Roll. There's not a lot of room for innuendo there. It feels like that's fairly easy to interpret.
She was hungry. She needed some lunch.
She wanted to have a dinner party, obviously.
When people say, oh, you know, have we reached the absolute bottom as far as lyrics can go, you know, is Blurred Lines the worst or whatever, you know, I just point them toward the 20s blues queens, because that was a time of amazing innuendo, amazing dirtiness in blues. Bessie Smith, of course, one of the most popular recording artists of the first years of recording. And there's just an art to it. There was an art to smut at that time that I love. And I think these women voiced it so wonderfully with that big, frank way of singing, you know, that just puts it right out there.
Well, and I love that there's a sort of emotional appeal in the beginning of it.
Yeah.
She wants a man to tell her troubles to.
Yeah, and tell her troubles to and get a little back rub as well.
Okay, Ann Powers, we're going to time travel about 25 years or so, World War II, post-World War II era. You write about the invention of the teenager. That grabbed my attention. It never occurred to me that a teenager was invented, that was an invention. What did you mean by that?
In the U.S., the teenager became the absolute focus of popular culture, of social hope and anxiety. After World War II, so many American men had gone, their lives had been lost, or many came back damaged. There was a lot of fear about the future of the youth of America, and teens got thrust into this strange space of being asked to be more adult than maybe they were ready for, but also because of post-war economic prosperity, also being given more leisure time, more consumer power, encouraged to be young for a longer time. So this is happening at the same time. And the teenager is sort of that weird creature, that weird hybrid creature who is, you know, both grown and a kid. And how that connects to sex, of course, is that teens were being encouraged to date very young sometimes, even by their own parents. You know, I found all these amazing sort of manuals, like for parents or for kids, like how to negotiate being a teenager and dating, and what do you do about your urges? How do you only go to second base or something? You know, one of my favorites advised boys when they felt these strong urges to take up hiking or other vigorous activities. That probably worked a lot here in Seattle. There are a lot of opportunities to hike. But we always think of rock and roll at that time as being the spirit of the teen and the spirit of the liberation of the teen. But what I hear in it is so much anxiety and so much uncertainty about how to behave and how to handle these new responsibilities, including erotic responsibilities.
That's a really nice introduction into the next song that I wanted to play for you, this song, Baby Let's Play House by Elvis. Well, you may go to college, you may go to school, you may have a pink Cadillac, but don't you be nobody's fool. And now, baby, come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, I want to play house with you. It's interesting to listen to those lyrics about, you know, you may go off on your own, you may go to college, you might be able to accomplish things, maybe even buy yourself a car, but really, I want you to come back and play house with me.
Right.
That really speaks to what you're talking about, that idea of the roles you're supposed to be playing, how you're supposed to be an adult, and that coupling up and having that life as a married couple, playing house, I'm scare quoting that, matters.
So the teenage girl is so important in the 50s. She has a lot of power as a consumer, as a culture maker, as a facilitator of rock and roll. You know, teenage girls, they ran the fan clubs. They got the word out about these stars. Girls who were not much past their teenage years were often working at fan magazines. So rock and roll was really shaped not just by the screams of teenage girls, but by their opinions and their vision. At the same time, what's the goal for a teenage girl in the 50s? It's still to go play house, right? And so that exactly, that very thing, it's a great example of the confusion I'm talking about. I'd rather see you dead, little girl, than to be with another man. And I'd love it, baby, come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, I won't play house with you.
We've talked a lot about innuendo, about really clever language around sex. We haven't heard anybody say the actual word sex in any of the songs we've listened to yet. I mean, there's an explicitness to lyrics today that I don't think was present then. And I wonder how that influences that dialogue you were talking about.
Well, we're living in a different era as far as accessibility to explicit material. And one reason why you don't hear the dirty words in recordings of the past is because radio is regulated. That's why Little Richard changed the lyrics to Tutti Frutti.
Right. Booty was not allowed.
Yeah. Or they thought it wouldn't be. And now kids, adults, anyone, you know, they can listen to whatever they want. So I think that's one reason for the rising amount of flat out obscenity in lyrics. At the same time, I think there's still some good innuendo happening out there. You know, Nicki Minaj gave us Anaconda not too long ago. That art still exists.
Fair enough. But I wanted to talk a little bit more about the connection between technology and the way, you know, what we have access to and what that means for people who are making music. You connect technology with Britney Spears, which I had not expected. So... So how does Britney Spears and this technology that you're talking about, all of this access, what's the connection there?
Well, Britney Spears was one of the first superstars of the age of digital natives. So her fan base is the first generation to grow up with online access, to be using chat rooms. Britney and the boy bands who came up alongside her, like NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, were among the first artists to be marketed via the internet. And also the sound of her music, very much synthesizer oriented and processed. She had that voice that worked perfectly. There, you know, Hit Me Maybe One More Time, you can hear it in the way she shapes her syllables. On later songs like Toxic, it's almost like her voice is a synthesizer. And so I have a little fun talking about Britney as a cyborg.
Yes, I found that really interesting. A cyborg figure. What does that mean exactly?
I mean, she's not really a cyborg as far as I can tell, or a replicant. I'm a big Blade Runner fan. But, you know, the way in which she embodied kind of all-American sweetheart style wholesomeness, but also this perfection that could only be achieved through various forms of enhancement. And those forms of enhancement were more accessible to more people than ever in the 21st century, and alongside the fluid life online that kids have been leading, there's also much more access to plastic surgery, to steroid use, especially for boys, to, you know, just various forms of perfecting yourself in a cyborgian way. And I think Britney was really the star who embodied that shift, which is a very deep shift and which changes our sense of our sexuality along with our sense of our very being. She's the queen of that.
So if Britney is the queen of that, but it's a deep shift, where else do you see that cyborg influence?
Well, I don't know if we're trying to get to Beyonce here. But
we can always get to Beyonce. I'm happy to go to Beyonce. Yeah.
I mean, I go from talking about Britney to talking about Beyonce. And, you know, if you are simply looking for sort of cyborg imagery, the Single Ladies video, you know, she's wearing that glove, which was called the Gling. She's in what filmmakers call an infinity cove with that white background. So it seems like she's sort of in this 2001 A Space Odyssey type space. It's important, though, when we talk about the augmented self or the virtual self, that we also remember at this moment in history, we're painfully aware of how bodies are still being violated, and particularly how African-American people, African-American bodies are still being violated. Black Lives Matter movement was happening all through the time I was writing this book and was so much on my mind. And Black Lives Matter and this new civil rights movement is so grounded in what I'm talking about, with technology allowing for us to witness what's happening to people's bodies. So both exist at the same time. And until we, you know, enter that Star Trek age, that Star Trek episode where, you know, where all we are is a big brain that floats above a table or whatever. Do you remember that episode?
Yes.
That was my favorite episode when I was a kid. But until we enter that space, we are in bodies and we experience everything that Bessie Smith experienced, everything that, you know, Jimi Hendrix experienced, everything that Elvis experienced. And those truths remain central to our lives.
That's Ann Powers, NPR music writer. Her new book is Good Booty, Love and Sex, Black and White, Body and Soul in American Music. She talked with KUOW's Jeannie Yandel.